Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power, and we shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together. In other words, to address problems rather than just defend positions. Well, you know, the presidential campaign has often been characterized as a popularity contest and a beauty pageant. However, if we think back to the 2016 election, featuring two of the least liked candidates in history, it might have been called an unpopularity contest and an ugly pageant. Indeed, as my wife Trudy and I traveled the country that summer, the question everyone was asking was, so, who are you voting against? Now, 4 years later, not a lot has changed. We're facing a contest between a candidate who has sold his soul to the devil and another who's just renting his. Well, I exaggerate, but not too much. But every 4 years, the voter is forced to choose between whichever they perceive as a lesser evil. They are still voting for an evil, at worst, and an unsatisfactory choice at best. And yet, most Americans and 90% of millennials are clamoring for an alternative to this two-party polarity that keeps the dysfunction in place. Our guest on Wiki Politiki this week is Joel Searby. He has been treading this middle ground. In 2016, he managed Evan McMullen's independent campaign for president. McMullen, a never-Trump Republican, did manage to get 21% of the vote in his home state of Utah. Since that time, Joel has worked on several campaigns for independent candidates from both political parties, who are both dedicated to reform and to working across party lines. Joel Searby is a veteran consultant in the realm of political campaigning, government affairs, corporate and nonprofit strategic planning, leadership development, and faith-based initiatives. He's worked with campaigns and organizations across a wide spectrum of sizes and resources, local candidates for office to managing a presidential campaign, and from small trade associations with a few thousand members to some of the largest with over 100,000 members and multi-million dollar budgets. He and his wife Jen spent 6 months of their first year of marriage living in Santiago, Chile, serving with a church plant and working with young mothers, kids, drug addicts, and others in a rough part of the city. They are both fluent in Spanish and have traveled extensively in Central and South America. Well, so the question is there a sane and sacred center in America? Can we work together as most Americans seem to want? How do we reform or reformulate a system that has been consistently resistant to change? How do we assert our political will when faced with a binary choice, the evil of two lessers? And how do we assert political will in between elections so that we have better choices? I'm happy to bring Joel Searby onto the show. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you, Steve. So good to be here, and thank you for that that really warm welcome.
Good, good. Well, let's start with what sparked you to become involved with this independent political movement and independent political campaigns.
Sure. Well, I think the best way to explain that is just to tell the story. I worked for a very large Republican consulting firm. I had been there for about 11 years, started my political career there as a young guy. and worked my way up through the ranks, became the CEO of that firm in 2014. And I was growing less and less comfortable with the direction of the Republican Party, though my core principles and values never changed as I see them. I just saw it getting more and more toxic in really the whole political realm. But there were certain ways that Republican operatives and consultants would talk about other people and other races and immigrants. And the only way to win was to destroy and to use negative campaigning. And so I just was growing more and more uncomfortable with the whole scenario. And again, keep in mind, I had become the CEO of a very large, prominent Republican consulting firm. But 2016 rolled around, and I often say that was the punchline of the story. But what really happened was I woke up in one morning in February of 16, and of course, by that time, we didn't know who the nominees were, but I had a pretty strong feeling from my perspective that it was going to be Trump and Clinton, and that these were two historically unpopular candidates. And as you pointed out, so many people were using the line the lesser of two evils already at that point. And so I just began exploring and researching, quite honestly, what it would take to run an independent candidate. I did that secretly from my company's owner, and ultimately began to use some of our employees to help with that. And one thing led to another, until I really became kind of obsessed with it and got connected with a number of other people in the Republican Party who were feeling the same way. Guys like Bill Kristol, who's a conservative commentator, and Rick Wilson, and Stuart Stevens, who ran Romney's campaign, and a number of other people. And I had done all the work in terms of understanding what it would take to do ballot access. I had talked to Ross Perot's legal team, and one thing led to another, and we found ourselves meeting with a lot of prominent folks, household names, trying to get them to run for president as an independent. And by June of 2016, it became obvious to me I could no longer be the CEO of a Republican consulting firm. And so I left the party, and I resigned as CEO and walked away from a very lucrative job to continue trying to recruit a candidate. I can pause there if you want me to continue the story from there to the McMullen campaign. It continues to be interesting, but I'll stop
well,
there.
Good. That's kind of how I got to the end. Well, let's go backward a little bit before we go forward, because this is really important. What you started to discover about the toxicity of politics. I have a friend whose father was a congressman when she was growing up in Washington, D.C. in the 50s and 60s, and what she remembers is that they would always have people over to the house from different political parties. They all socialized with one another. Her dad was a Democrat, but the Chief Justice Earl Warren was a frequent guest at their house. That was 50 years ago. What's happened? What has happened that has created this polarization?
Well, as you can imagine, I spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., and I hear it from lots of friends, and over the last 8 to 10 years, it's just gotten so bad. To take your story a little further, of course, all of that socializing used to happen, and now they're afraid. I think what's happened to that question, Steve, is that media has changed to a real gotcha game and a real-time event where you have things like Twitter and Facebook reporting any kind of impurities, so to speak, in this mm-hmm. very tribal time. And so people are afraid to be together simply because they're afraid to be seen and then chastised by people in their party and leadership and their base. And so, honestly, it boils down to this. It's fear. They're afraid. And I can tell you, I won't call anybody out, but I will tell you that that is why the prominent folks who didn't run that we recruited to run as an independent, that's why they didn't run. They were afraid. Mm-hmm. They were afraid of losing their current seat. They were afraid of losing friends. They were afraid of losing influence and money and power. And that's what it really boiled down to for not all of them, but for a good portion of them.
Yeah, and I think that this gotcha game is really, really has to do with how and I think you point this out in some of the posts I've seen, that what happens in these districts is that the most radical candidates win the all blue or the all red districts. Mm-hmm. And so then these people are expected to come to Congress with the strong ideological expectations from their constituencies, and then it's a different game, and
well,
they can't
me,
play.
Let me dive into that just a little for your listeners, because I think this is an important point of education for folks, and most people don't take the time to understand this. What's happening in the scenario you just described is that both parties are always fighting for control of legislative bodies. And that just means that they need to have one or more votes than the other party so that they can move their agenda through. Now, one of the ways that they have discovered that they can do that is through what's called the redistricting process. And so as district lines need to change with the changing population and demographics, people move, numbers change, those things come up usually every 10 years with the census, and sometimes other states have it through different channels. And both parties fight very hard to draw their district lines in a way that will give their party the most districts. And what ends up happening is they create what are called safe districts so that they can just kind of set those aside in their drawing process and only focus on the difficult ones. And those districts become very Republican or very Democratic. And it allows the candidates, or actually forces the candidates who run in those districts, to take the most extreme hardline positions in order to win a primary where you're only competing for either the Democratic or the Republican votes. And then when you get into the situation of governing, you are really governing only to that small constituency because they're the ones that are going to reelect you. And it just creates a really difficult situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly right. And so let's get back to the campaign. So you are all of the candidates that you had thought about approaching for the reasons that you suggested just didn't want to step into that toxic pool. So how did Evan McMullen emerge, and how did that happen?
Yeah, so we talked to Condoleezza Rice and Mitt Romney, and we talked to General Jim Mattis, who is an incredibly fine human being, and then Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska, a whole bunch of other folks, and this is all, it's been written about since then. And we got to the end of the summer, and the conventions happened, and we had no candidate. And our main funder, who had spent over $1 million just helping us try to recruit a candidate, said, "I'm done. I'm out." Great man, a guy named John Kingston, and he said, I'm out. I got to be done." So honestly, I was incredibly dejected. I had no job. I had quit my job, and I went on a vacation that was previously planned to my in-laws. I was sitting by the garage drinking a beer, trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And this was in late July, and I got a phone call from a guy I'd never heard of before, and he said, "I understand you're the guy to talk to if you want to run for president." And it was Evan. And so we had a long talk. I said, "We got to meet if you're serious." We met in Chicago at a hotel for 2 days. I kind of laid out the essential impossibility of doing it, but the fact that there was at least a network of people who wanted someone to try. And a few days later, he called me back and said, "Let's do it." I flew to D.C. and we launched a presidential campaign 4 days later, and got really what is to most political observers an incredible amount of traction. We ended up getting about 870,000 votes nationally, and as you mentioned, 21% of the vote in Utah. And really, we're proud of what we did. We knew we were not in it to win it. We had a strategy, of course, but it was really about standing up and offering folks an alternative.
You know, in 2016, many Christian conservatives rallied around Donald Trump, who would appear to be the antithesis of anything, either Christian or conservative. However, in Utah, the LDS, Latter-day Saints, Mormon people, were not snookered by Trump, and they went out for their candidate, Evan McMullen, 21% of the vote for a relatively unknown. What do you think is the difference? You know, why did these other, so-called conservative, so-called Christian groups rally around Trump, and why the resistance of the LDS folks in Utah?
Sure. Well, obviously, deeply complicated question. I should say to the listeners and to you that I identify as a Jesus follower and certainly grew up in what would be considered a conservative Christian home, although I've kind of tried to shed the label of quote-unquote evangelical because that means a lot of things to a lot of folks. And I will just say as a personal note, it was devastating to me to watch so many people of faith whom I respected support Donald Trump for the reasons you point out, because it was just an antithesis of our basic faith of character and leadership and kindness and the ways that we are taught to treat people in our faith. And then I was also heartened by how many folks who were not Christians were standing up. And of course, I have many friends of other faiths and love that about our country. But as it relates to what happened in Utah, I think there was a couple of things happening there. First of all, because Evan himself was LDS, And the LDS folks, really very early on, Mitt Romney and others were denouncing Trump's behavior, and the leadership of the LDS church, specifically not in the church, but the kind of the political power players, many of them came out very early against Donald Trump. And so they already had kind of permission, and the LDS community is very tight-knit, very much looks to its leaders for a lot of direction. And so there was already a groundwork laid. So had someone like Romney, you know, run as an independent, he would have won Utah easily, for example, because there was already that kind of permission for folks to say, I'm going to take a look at a different candidate. And then, you know, being on the ground in Utah, we spent a lot of time in Utah, but the last month almost exclusively in Utah. What I saw up close was that people there are just really wholesome and decent, and it more probably than a lot of other folks. The ways of Donald Trump, the words of Donald Trump really flew in the face of their way of life. And so they were just starving for someone who was just simply a kind, decent, respectable human being who held their same values. And that's what we offered in Evan.
Interesting. So what did you end up? We got about a minute till we take a break. What did you end up learning from the campaign with Evan?
Oh, gosh, so much. I learned how hard it is to get on the ballot as an independent presidential candidate. It's, I think, criminal in some states how hard they make it. But I also learned that there's really a tremendous number of wonderful people who are looking for a different way in our politics. And they're not all just, you know, never Trump Republicans. There's so many independents. There's so many folks who identify as very progressive and liberal who also are disillusioned with the Democratic Party. And we built a really interesting coalition, both in our staff and across the country. And so that was really probably the big takeaway for me, was just to say there might be something here that's bigger.
You know, I think there is something that's bigger. After this break, we'll come back and talk about how we can build this radical center from a different place. I'm talking with Joel Searby, and this is Wiki Politiki.
With the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
A social distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others, and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Well, we're back on Wiki Politiki with our guest Joel Searby, and we're really talking about how to lead from a different center, a center that doesn't seem to be very well acknowledged in the mainstream media, which tends to focus on and actually add to the polarization. Why don't you talk a little bit about how it is to – I know that you've also done a couple of other campaigns. So talk about – you had – I think there were 4 independent campaigns you were involved with in this past election. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that and who those were, and I guess – I think they all won, right?
Well, I wish that was true. But let me go back a little bit to how I got connected to this group. There's a group called Unite America, which was really one of the first truly organized independent candidate mechanisms. So just like the Republicans and Democrats have parties behind them, part of the problem for independent candidates is they don't have the infrastructure. They don't have a network of donors and operatives and data and all the things you need to run an effective campaign. And so the vision for Unite America, which is an organization I served for a couple of years in 17 and 18, part 19, and still an amazing organization, the vision was to provide that infrastructure. And so what we found was that as soon as they got off the ground, as we got off the ground, we began to really have a kind of a magnetic process happen where candidates were flocking to us because they really wanted this stuff. And at the time, one of the really important things we were able to do is connect up with the only sitting independent governor in the country, which was Bill Walker of Alaska. And Governor Walker is an incredible human being, governed in all the ways you're probably hoping for from this conversation. And so we had the pleasure of working with Governor Walker, and I helped him with his campaign, his reelection, but also had other candidates running for governor and U.S. Senate around the country, as well as a whole bunch of local candidates. And no, unfortunately, very few of them won. We had several local and a few state legislative wins, but the big time candidates in Senate and governor's races, they all lost. And so we had a lot of takeaways from that and have been trying to learn from that. But there was no doubt there was a ton of demand. And what we would see is we would see early spikes of really big popularity and interest. And that's because there is a huge center, and every poll of any reputable nature in the country will tell you that the actual, there's a plurality of independents in this country, people who don't identify with either party. The problem comes when you are forced into, usually by the mainstream media and the parties themselves, this binary thinking, then people get scared and they feel like they have to choose one or the other, and they have to vote against the people that they hate the most. And so people really are not ready to break out of that, in my opinion, at the electoral level just yet. But there's some really important work happening to continue that. I think there is a day coming, it's my prediction, that in the next 5 to 7 years, we'll see, rather than a third party, I think we'll see, I hope, my hope, my what I'm cheering and rooting for and in some ways working for is kind of a multi-party system, much more in the form of some of the European countries.
You know, I noticed, I don't know if it was on the Better America site or the Unite site, one of the platforms that you advocate for is ranked choice voting. And a lot of people don't understand ranked choice voting. So why don't you say a little bit about that and why it would make a difference?
Sure. And as I do, I'll note that Unite America has really shifted its focus as one of the things that it learned in 2018 to reform efforts and gathering finances to support reform efforts. So ranked choice voting is really a simple idea, which is that when you go into the ballot box, instead of having to choose only one candidate, you get to rank your favorite candidates, starting with the one you hope wins, the your top rate, and then your second one. And what that does is it takes away the fear of saying, well, if I don't vote for this guy, it's a wasted vote in one hand. Or it also says, you know, my vote has extra power because what happens in ranked choice voting, the way it works functionally, it actually is already enacted in several states and municipalities. Maine used it last year for its statewide races. It allows you to say, I'm going to, if my vote doesn't go to my top guy or my top guy doesn't win or gal, then my vote automatically goes to my second choice and therefore is not wasted and actually creates a really powerful situation.
Right, right. And of course, you know, there's you probably are familiar with Represent Us, the Unrig the System people, you know, and so there are these organizations that are, you know, moving kind of slowly, but they're moving in the right direction toward creating these reforms at the at the local level, ending the gerrymandering, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems like a very slow way to go. And at the same time, one thing that we haven't seen, and think about this as the amazing possibilities that we have, particularly now that we're sequestered in place, of communicating with one another. And what we haven't seen is a new kind of freedom of assembly where people from across the political spectrum actually have conversations about purpose and conversations about quality qualities so that they rehumanize one another. There is one platform called Living Room Conversations. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Joan Blades and John Gable, left and right, bringing people together in conversations that are designed, you know, not to convince one another necessarily, but to actually learn how to listen, and then, of course, in the process, recognize that quite often these political enemies that we create are really straw men. They don't really exist. They're just exaggerations. So in this particular time when you know, and you and I both know this, that there is a longing to actually create functional government and functional system, you know, what is it that what is the big obstacle now, and then what is it that encourages you?
Sure. Well, I think the biggest obstacle is the two parties themselves. And I don't mean to say that in some kind of big, bad boogeyman kind of way. There are real power players within each party whose business interests, financial interests, personal agendas are very much tied up in their ability to move the policies and ideas of their political parties. And they see it as an existential battle. And so when you view something as existential, you will fight in that way. And so they are willing to push others out at all costs, knowing it's the one thing that Republicans and Democrats agree on is that they don't want any competition, because as long as they hold this stranglehold on any kind of third party oxygen, they know that they've got at least a 50-50 shot. In any given election. We've seen that. I mean, we had brutal opposition coming from folks, and even in Evans' campaign, even though we were, you know, everybody knew we were not going to, you know, be the leading vote getter. We had a slim chance of throwing it to the House of Representatives. But even then, we were getting death threats, and we had to hire, you know, paid security to 24/7 because it was just toxic out there. And so the people who are most holding on to this are the partisans themselves, for reasons, I believe, of mostly power and power tied with money. And so, you know, the folks that are working on reform are focusing largely on unwinding that power and de-influencing that money. And I think it is absolutely the right angle. It's not my passion. It's not what I focus on, the reform stuff. But there is, you mentioned it being slow. They've had a really good couple of years, some very big wins in really beginning to change some of that. In terms of, and that gives me hope. I think the other thing that gives me hope is that, how do I say this tactfully? A lot of the folks who are holding so tightly to some of these ideologies are going away, whether they're passing away out of old age or whether they are losing their influence in other ways. There is a rising tide of folks who just simply don't identify with either party and truly are looking for another way. What has lacked is the combination of really charismatic top-level leadership that really can galvanize those folks, and then just enough resources. You know, some people will tell me, oh, you got to have $50 million to even begin to start something different. And I see their point. I've seen the PowerPoint decks, but it doesn't have to be that much. It can be something significant that's not that much money, with a combination of really charismatic leaders who take to certain specific races and approaches where people can grab on and say, I will vote for this person in this race. Because it's the right thing to do. And so I'm hopeful of that. I'm also hopeful, you know, or I think one of the things we may talk about a little bit is I'm hopeful with all the collaborations that I'm seeing. Those of us who care a lot about this stuff have dropped a lot of other weapons and barriers, so to speak, to work together on this stuff. And, you know, I'd like to think I've always been an open, tolerant, kind person. I have a lot of friends from lots of different backgrounds who are completely welcome and embraced in my life. But the diversity of this kind of space, this kind of third way political space, is really, really encouraging to me. Even within our quote unquote conservative, never Trump independent presidential campaign, we had people from six different religions, 10 different races, male, female, gay, straight, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, you know, Hindu, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, atheist, New Age. It was, we had the whole nine yards, and it was just a beautiful thing to see. And I realized there was something deeper going on, that folks were looking for this collaboration and looking for ways that they could do it tangibly. So I'm really encouraged by that.
Well, you know, we jokingly call it the great upwising, because people are waking up and wising up, and they're waking up to how we have been, how we've allowed ourselves. You know, it's not like some dominator doing it. We've allowed ourselves to be divided and conquered. And there is a way to unite around these virtues and values that, you know, the 90% of us who aren't sociopaths favor. And we haven't until now been able to do that because of this very convenient polarization that has pulled us apart. And when I was at the – I went to the Unrigged conference when they first started in 2018 in New Orleans. And what I was so impressed by were how many young people, how many people in their 20s and 30s who they had their beliefs, and they might have even belonged to a political party. But there was an independent spirit that they had that unhooked them from these – tired ideologies that have not gone anywhere, that pull us back into a polarized past. And I noticed that in your one of the sites, I don't remember which one, you cited that 90% of millennials are looking for an independent third way. So talk a little more about that and how that is likely to impact our system over the next decade.
Yeah, well, I think it's a demographic certainty in my opinion. I don't see how it goes any other direction. I think it's only a question of when. Like I said earlier, I see it potentially in the next 5 to 7 years. They're just becoming such a demand for something different by the voters, because really that's when voters start speaking with their votes and their feet and their money. That's when things will start to really change. And I realize that sounds trite and cliche, but it is absolutely true. It's only going to take a handful of people really breaking out of that system to begin to build new coalitions. And you're already seeing it. That's why one of the reasons why I predict it is because, go back to your point about the millennials. If you want to look at the quote unquote squad in the Democratic Party, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC as they call her, and Ilhan Omar and a few others, they are in that younger crowd, and they have absolutely made a big splash in the Democratic Party, and they've been a thorn in the side of the Democratic Party. Whether you agree or disagree with their policies is irrelevant to the question here, which is that by banding together this younger, kind of newer, looking for a different way, tired of some of the old Democratic policies, they have really impacted significantly the shape of certain policies and the party itself. And I think we're just a few years away, especially if Trump loses in this cycle, from something similar happening in the Republican Party, just a real splintering and some new folks saying, hey, I'm still generally kind of over here in this camp, but I've just been waiting for my opportunity, and this is crazy, and we've got to have something different. And the parties may not allow that, and that's where you'll see, I think, once people are in office and have some real clout and some power, if they can break free at that point, like Justin Amash has, for example, in the House.
Yes, exactly.
You could see that continue.
You know, it's interesting when you actually get past the media imposed barriers between the sides, and you really get into conversations. That's when you find out that people really have very similar aspirations, and they may have different pathways that they're attracted to for achieving those things. But you know, most of the people, I think people start out in political domain to be of service in some way. And, you know, we live in a very cynical time. And so those motivations are really cast aside by the operatives who say you have to do this and you have to do that. Talk a little more about the collaborations that you've seen. Are you noticing that there's actually collaborations in governance, in state houses, in Congress, et cetera, across the political lines?
You know, we see it most beautifully at the local level, which, of course, is where government is closest to the people. And so I would say to people who might be listening and asking, what can I do? Get involved in your local politics. You have outsized influence, number one, because a smaller number of votes can elect the people that you want to elect. Number two, there's almost no local governments other than big cities where you can't get your actual city representative, whether they're councilperson or county commissioner, on the phone personally. You can certainly email them. And so your ability to influence at that level and to call for this kind of collaboration is really outsized. So I would encourage folks to do that. And we do see that happening in a lot of smaller towns and smaller cities. There's been some notable exceptions of independent mayors who mayor in South Dakota, in Sioux Falls, a mayor in New York, Syracuse, the mayor of Syracuse was an independent. And so there's just been some really good examples of that. At the state legislative level, you're starting to see a little bit more of it, although there was some pretty serious regression this past year where folks kind of retrenched on a lot of that. And in Congress, you know, other than some backroom dealing and a few friendships that still kind of hang on, you're really not seeing much of it.
Yeah, well, you know, I think what we saw in 2018, and even for this coming election, we saw a number of primarily Republican legislators say, "I'm leaving. I'm out of it. I'm not going to run again."
Yes. Yep.
And I think that's probably a reaction to what you've been talking about. I had this idea years ago of a front and center party, which wouldn't be a real political party, but it would be front and center Democrats and front and center Republicans. And, you know, they would actually be talking about collaboration prior to the election, that, you know, they'd be coming from a quote unquote conservative point of view or quote unquote progressive or liberal point of view. But again, I think that there's more functional iterations of those points of view than what we've seen in politics over the last couple of decades. So mm-hmm. I could see where conservative values are really valuable in these cases, and progressive values are really valuable in these other cases. And I know my joke is I'm proposing a sane world. I must be crazy. But the idea of actually using these two political tendencies instead of trying to destroy one another to be dynamic duo dance partners so that we actually are able to use them. We have a short break coming. We're going to be back and talk more with Joel Searby. We'll be talking about the independent political movement. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, we're back with our guest, Joel Searby. We're talking about independent political campaigns. Joel, there's something I wanted to ask that you mentioned earlier about the diversity of the people involved in this campaign for Evan McMullen. And one of the things I realize is that one of the missing pieces, I'm calling it this a sane and sacred center. And, you know, as we become a more secularized society, what's happened is that there hasn't been a unifying sense of what is sacred, not being dominated by a particular religious point of view, but simply a general recognition of some spiritual value, of some sense of purpose, that's something that's bigger than the individual rat race that people find themselves in. I know that your background it's a faith-based background. How do you see recreating a sane and sacred center where it's collaborative and people don't feel like that it moves beyond religion and non-religion, if that makes any sense?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question, Steve, and it's something that I care a lot about. I think that there's a couple of elements that are very difficult about this. Number one is folks who have that worldview of some kind of value of the sacred, or even just, you know, basic kind of decorum and value of the other, very much want to see a kind of movement like this politically. And we saw that with Evan's campaign. We drew those kinds of folks to the campaign. The challenge with a lot of us who are like that is that we tend to believe that the world does not revolve around politics either. And so it becomes a challenge, and it's been a challenge in my own life to say, how far do I fight this fight? And when do I retreat and simply love my neighbor and love my family and try to do good in my own community instead of trying to fight this very difficult, very costly war of politics? So I think that's one dynamic. The same folks that you're mentioning who will band together from time to time also have a little different view of the world that, okay, well, politics is terrible right now, but it's also not the only ultimate thing that matters to me. So that's one element that I think makes it a challenge. Yeah. But I also want to answer your question about how do we do it. The only thing I can say is what I've done, which is to put it into action. Go work with folks with whom you disagree on things that you both care about. And my example of that is, you know, again, having grown up in a kind of conservative Christian home and still hold a lot of those values. But I am committed to the radical center and working together on things that matter. And so I worked in 2018. One of my top clients was the ACLU, who, of course, in my old stomping grounds would have been seen as the devil incarnate, you know, as a liberal progressive radical group. And what I told them, and my good friend Faz Shakir, who was the director at the time and then managed Bernie's campaign, I said, listen, Faz, we're not going to agree. They have 10 pillars that they put up. I said, we're not going to agree on these six. But on these other four, man, I am with you almost 100%. And so if we can fight together on those. And what we ended up doing was working on Florida's Amendment 4, which was the restoration of felons' voting rights. And so around the issue of criminal justice and restoring the rights of formerly incarcerated folks, we were so aligned. And I did the faith outreach work here in Florida, and we won that campaign. We passed that amendment. And it was a beautiful thing. I became really good friends with some of those folks at the ACLU. And so that's an example of putting our hands to the plow on the issue we both care about, even though on other things we have a lot of divergent views.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent example, because what happens is, you know, we tend to be manipulated by media narratives, which tend to provide a lot of heat and not a lot of light. So those narratives tend to create this chasm, this polarity. And when we rehumanize after we've been dehumanized, and we take the disagreements out of the foreground, and in the foreground we begin to work together for those things that that we find are valuable, there's just nothing like that. And I've had, you know, similar situations with people who we'll agree to disagree about that, but thank God we all agree about this. And this is what's in the foreground. And you mentioned local issues, and I think that there's a great opportunity for these living room conversations to actually burgeon into conversations about shared purpose. I work with a colleague, Joseph McCormick, who is a conservative transpartisan pioneer, and he would begin these meetups. He was very successful in bringing different groups together, and ultimately, after they all stopped yelling at each other, began to learn from one another. And he did this in Seattle and a number of other places. But one of the first things he did was he asked people to tell their stories. What was America to you when you were a child? And so all of a sudden, when people begin to relate their personal stories, there's a rehumanization that takes place, and people can begin to relate to them as people instead of stereotypes. So I think there might be something to that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I love what you're talking about rehumanizing and just getting up close with folks. It's so beautiful when it happens. And we realize, I think, sometimes with a bit of embarrassment, the ways in which we have been putting each other in boxes. And so, yeah, there's some great groups doing some stuff out there on that right now. And for anybody who's listening, I would just encourage you find those groups or just find issues locally that you can work together with people, no matter what their political background is, because you agree on that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I get that. And so you've talked about also the personal conflict of, you know, in my family, I tell people what I was doing, and they'd say, "From this, you make a living." You know, so the answer was, "Well, yeah, traveling around doing comedy at conferences." But how do you create that balance, and what might be next for you right now?
Yeah, well, I took most of 2019 off of politics. I needed a personal break, and I did a lot of strategic planning and worked with nonprofits and leaned into some work that I really care about, both in the faith sector and in the justice and literacy sectors. And so I think, you know, I took a break, and I'm looking at what's next, what's happening in 2020. Should I get involved again in politics, more directly and diving into campaigns? After having done it for 15 years, I just felt like maybe 1 year off would be a good idea. But I think for me, you know, I'm pouring most of my energies right now into kind of the stuff we've been talking about, which is how do I work with folks who are radically different from me, whether that's from a faith perspective and a project I'm working on called the American Awakening, or whether that's from a political perspective and trying to remain friends with folks who are big time Trump supporters when they know that I, you know, nearly gave my life to oppose the man, or whether it's working on issues like criminal justice reform with my progressive friends who I don't share views on certain things, but we absolutely align on those things. So I'm constantly looking for those opportunities, and also just being involved locally. I mean, we didn't mention it before. My wife and I own a local retail shop here in our little town that sells vintage home goods, and we host flea markets on our property, and just really trying to stay connected to our home community here.
You know, that's really where it's happening. I'm curious. Tell me about this awakening, this project, this book, or whatever it is you're working on. I'm curious about that.
Sure. The American Awakening is a group of people who essentially, we all come from very different political and racial backgrounds, all people of faith, mostly from kind of a bent toward Jesus, although we have a lot of friends in our group that are not Christians. We have people who are from other faiths or no faith at all. But our basic tenet is that one of the deepest needs in this country right now, after many of us have gone through political battles, and we kind of said, now, wait a minute, I think there's some really much deeper stuff going on out here. So, going to that deeper place of the soul where there's depression, isolation, and loneliness, and deaths of despair are an all-time high in this country from opioid addictions and suicide, depression, and really trying to just give people some hope that, hey, you're loved. It's going to be okay. There are people that will support you. And just speaking that into the world every day through we have a daily live show on Facebook. We have a podcast that's been really successful, hundreds of thousands of downloads already. And also a book by our funder and founder, John Kingston, coming out in June. We had plans to put on a lot of really cool events, but those are all on hold right now with COVID. But yeah, it's a band of folks that are radically diverse from one another in a lot of ways, just trying to speak that message of hope and light and love and togetherness into the world.
you know, I think that there's often been a chasm between the people who have been interested in personal development and those who've been into politics. And I got started in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, in Washington, D.C. as a radical young teacher, et cetera, et cetera. And I got very disillusioned with that because I really looked at people who are essentially playing out their anti-authoritarian childhood or whatever, and very immature, spiritually immature. And so that got me, put me on a journey of really much more internal work and self-discovery, also very diverse and eclectic. And nothing really changes without the individual changing. And I think people tend to look outside of themselves to some kind of political messiah, political savior, some great leader or hero. And I think that, that in this next period of time, it's a critical mass of the heretofore uncritical masses cultivating exactly what you're talking about, cultivating that inner strength, that inner connection, that part that we've tended to turn over to external authorities, and recognize that we're really all in the same boat, even if we are even if we may have different ways of accessing, you know, that spiritual truth. So
yeah,
you may have no idea.
Find some peace.
Yeah, and find some peace. Exactly. No, I was going to say you may have no idea of the positive influence you're having. Yes. So say more. Say more about this. I think my listeners need to hear this.
Let's just be blunt about it. A lot of folks are voting and acting politically out of fear. The fear of the other, fear of the unknown, fear of the less, voting for the worst evil. And that is an inner problem. You know, when you lack peace, that is something that's going on in your soul and in your heart and your head and your mind, all kind of wrapped up. And so no matter what background you come from, faith, no faith, you know, however you approach that, either eclectically or through a traditional religion, they all universally, one thing that, you know, many faiths have a lot of things in common, but one of the things that they're all seeking is not more fear, right? It's the opposite of fear. It's more peace.
Yeah.
It's more,
yeah,
more exactly. Centering, more groundedness. And then from that, the ability to live a life that actually looks like the principles of that faith. And so I think whatever system or approach folks are taking, continue on in that inner work and then let it become a peace inside you that motivates your political decisions, even if it's just something as simple as who you choose to vote for. Vote in peace, you know, don't vote in fear.
Wow, what a great prescription that is, because I think that's fundamentally it. And those who benefit from manipulation, fear is the great tool that's been
yep.
used, and we've probably seen a lot of that. In this current, looking at the current, the new word that the Swami has coined is situation, and the current situation that we have. everybody knows what that means for some reason. With this lockdown or shelter in place, if you will, what do you see as the benefits and choice points that we face, having had to kind of close it down for 2 months? You know, what do you see are the upsides and benefits of moving forward from here?
Well, I think to the point of the topic we're talking about politically, politics has taken a back seat for a lot of folks, and I think that's a good thing. We needed a break from that. Now, that doesn't mean that what is out there politically is not still toxic. I certainly still see it everywhere on Facebook and Twitter and otherwise. But the fact that it's not dominating the headlines every single day, I think, has been a good thing. I hope folks are taking this time, whether their life is difficult right now because of job loss or sickness, or whether they are just kind of riding it out, that they would at some level embrace this time to step back and reevaluate, as we've been talking about, those inner life issues, so that when we all together reemerge into society, whatever that looks like in our local areas, that we're taking with us maybe a little more centeredness and groundedness about what really matters. And when those political things rear their ugly heads, I certainly hope we'll remember this time, although, you know, I know we have short memories, but it's definitely one of the things I hope we take is just a gratitude for life itself, for family, for health and the things that we are facing, you know, to realize that whatever political fearmonger word of the day may be thrown around, that it's probably not true. And you can know that you've still got your health, you've still got your loved ones, and even if you don't, you've got other folks who care about you, and I hope that we see more of that.
You know, I think that the track that you're on right now, even though it may not seem overtly political, is really what is fundamentally required as a spiritual recalibration of this country. You know, if you look back to the founding of this country and the fact that there was a sense of purpose, sense of principle, there was courage, and you know, in 2016, you were looking for an individual of courage who is willing to take the mantle of bucking the system and standing for something that's much deeper than whatever the current political conversation is. And so in helping Americans awaken and helping people help one another and stay connected to their own spiritual center and cultivate that, you know, no matter what their background has or hasn't been, there's a way to actually recognize the ineffable, that the ineffable, whatever you call it, even if you don't call it anything, is something that informs our whole lives. Well, thank you Joel Searby, thank you so much for the work that you've been doing and the work that you do. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. We'll be back with you next week.